In 1960, one woman almost single-handedly stopped a medical disaster of epidemic proportions. In this episode, the story of how that woman saved untold numbers of children and how all of us today are better off for her mostly forgotten legacy. This is I Heart This, everybody. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. Her boss told her that it would be an easy case. Open and shut. No problems. It was September of 1960. A 46-year-old pharmacologist named Frances Oldham Kelsey had been working at the FDA for about a month. It was a job that she thought was temporary, something to hold her over until she could get back to research or practicing medicine. Of the jobs she'd been offered in Washington, she'd chosen this one because the FDA had agreed to pay her moving expenses from South Dakota. Frances's job was to head a small team that approved new drug applications. The new drug on her desk, the one her boss told her would be an easy case, was a sleeping pill named Kevadon. But the safety information from the manufacturer, a company called Richardson Merrill, troubled Frances. Much of the information had been translated from other languages since the drug had been developed in Europe and was already in use there. But these translations were often incorrect. Frances also recognized some of the testimonial authors as ones that had tried to publish suspicious articles in the past. But what really bothered her was how the application was more advertisement than science, consisting almost entirely of anecdotal testimonials, doctors praising its effectiveness in their patients. When she showed one section to her husband, also a pharmacologist who worked at the NIH, he described it as a collection of meaningless pseudoscientific jargon, apparently intended to impress chemically unsophisticated readers. This kind of sloppy, unscientific salesmanship was not out of the ordinary for the time. Drug applications were basically sales pitches. Representatives from the drug companies schmoozed with regulators. The whole process was, in the words of science historian Sam Keen, a joke. But Frances was the kind of person to take her responsibility seriously. The kind of person who, as a kid, had stood up in church before the whole congregation to admit to taking part in the baseball game that had broken one of the church windows. So now, despite a process and an institutional culture of acquiescence to the pharmaceutical companies, Frances delayed approval and sent a letter to Richardson Merrill. She outlined the application's shortcomings and requested clinical evidence to support the drug's safety. Richardson Merrill had charged an executive named F. Joseph Murray with negotiating Kevadon's approval with the FDA, and he was surprised by Frances's delay. In West Germany, the drug was already being distributed, both as a sedative and as a treatment for morning sickness, and it was popular, like 1 million doses per day popular. Who needed clinical trials when the drug was already in such widespread use? Besides, if Richardson Merrill could replicate that success, they stood to make a great deal of money. So Joseph Murray resubmitted the application without the clinical trials that Frances had requested. It was the beginning of a conflict that would last well over a year. As the weeks passed, Joseph grew impatient. Christmas was coming, and along with it, a seasonal increase in the use of sedatives. Richardson Merrill needed approval, or they would miss the hottest sales of the year. This was particularly urgent because the company had already invested in a stockpile of 10 million Kevadon tablets. One night, as winter approached, the company called Frances to explain the urgency. But Frances still hadn't seen any clinical data or information on side effects. The evidence that the company had sent was problematic. Frances explained that it was her job to evaluate the safety evidence, and she hadn't seen that evidence yet. When she did, and if that evidence was convincing, she would give her approval to Kevadon. Christmas came and went without evidence or approval. Then, in February, Frances was browsing a recent copy of the British Medical Journal when she came across something that made her sit up. It was a letter to the editors from a doctor in northern Scotland. He reported that four of his patients on the European form of the drug had experienced strange neurological symptoms. Tingling, numbness in the hands and feet, cramping, a loss of coordination. Had other readers noticed any similar side effects? Frances forwarded the concerns on to Richardson Merrill and requested that they investigate. As the months went by, pressure from Richardson Merrill to approve the drug intensified. Representatives from the company came to Francis's office. Calls came at all times of day, and Joseph Murray, usually a man of congenial smiles, became increasingly irritated. In an attempt to get around Francis, he called her bosses to complain. Was this really the FDA's position? I mean, what Francis was asking wasn't even clear. Did Richardson Merrill really have to deal with this petty bureaucrat? It's easy to imagine how Francis's job might be in the line, a disgruntled client on the phone with her boss. But those bosses stood firm. It was Francis's job to approve the drug's safety. She had the final say. Joseph would have to take it up with her. Francis Oldham was no stranger to this kind of social pressure. Born on a rural island off the coast of British Columbia in 1914, she had a reputation as a tomboy, at a time when tomboyishness was not becoming of a young lady. She was interested in math and science from a young age, and even in a time and place where women were almost universally excluded from those fields, she clearly had the intelligence, ambition, and stamina to pursue it. She graduated high school at 15, transferred to McGill, where she earned a master's in pharmacology, and then she applied to a PhD program at the University of Chicago, where she was only admitted because the department head, seeing the name Francis, mistook her for a man. It was there, at the University of Chicago, that Francis came face to face with the high stakes of unregulated drugs. During her second year, she was asked to help investigate a series of over 100 deaths associated with a medicine called elixir sulfanilamide, a kind of early antibiotic syrup. At the time, there were no laws requiring safety testing of pharmaceuticals in the United States. Francis and her team analyzed the elixir and found that the company had used diethylene glycol, what is now widely used in antifreeze, to dissolve the medicine. Among other effects, diethylene glycol leads to kidney failure and an agonizing death. The owner of the company was unrepentant, saying, "We have been supplying a legitimate professional demand." The public outrage that arose in the wake of this disaster led to an act of Congress that would finally require that new drugs be approved for safety by the FDA, the very law that Francis would later be enforcing. Francis became the first woman to receive a PhD in pharmacology. And during World War II, she worked to find anti-malarial alternatives to quinine drugs that were sickening U.S. soldiers in the tropics. It was during animal tests in this project that Francis observed how drugs that did not affect a mother could and did affect their unborn offspring. It was an observation that would have major effects on her investigation of Kevadon. So this was the petty bureaucrat that Joseph Murray was complaining of. A determined, brilliant woman with a passion for science and the strength of character to stand up for what was right. By 1960, when Frances and her husband decided to move to Washington, her experiences had uniquely prepared her for the job that she just happened into at the FDA. By September of 1961, a full year after Kevadon had been submitted for review, Richardson Merrill was still arguing from the same testimonials it had submitted with its original application, sometimes presenting them again word for word. Another Christmas was fast approaching, and Kevadon still hadn't been approved. And it became clear that Richardson Merrill wouldn't submit any clinical studies because there weren't any. Some executives suggested that maybe the drug could be approved with a warning label. In a last-ditch effort to cajole Francis into an approval, Joseph sent her a memo expressing his frustration and listing all the ways that she had been stonewalling him. Francis sent one back, politely explaining that she wasn't stonewalling. She was doing her job. If Richardson Merrill conducted trials, she would review them and either approve or deny the drug. Neither one of them had any inkling of the storm that was right on the horizon. On November 30th, Joseph called Francis. The German manufacturer of the drug was pulling it off the shelves. When Francis asked why, Joseph told her that the company had warned him that the drug may have caused some birth defects. Today, that drug is more commonly known by its generic name, thalidomide. Over the next few months, the story of thalidomide came to light. While it did appear to be safe for adults and children, it could be devastating to a developing fetus. A single pill, taken in the first weeks of pregnancy, at a time even before a woman is likely to know that she is pregnant, can stunt the growth of the fetus's limbs. Children born with this condition, called focomelia, often have extremely shortened, flipper-like arms and legs. Some were born missing chambers of their heart. Doctors had noticed the link between the drug and the birth defects, but the drug companies resisted and slowed the response. In the end, between 10 and 20,000 babies were born with limb or heart deformities because their mothers took thalidomide. And an untold number of miscarriages likely dwarfs those numbers. If Frances had ever doubted herself, here was a tragic vindication. With the evidence mounting, Richardson Merrill formally withdrew its application for thalidomide / Kevadon in March 1962. But by then, it had already distributed thousands of pills to doctors across the country. This was a common practice at the time, a kind of free samples advertisement campaign that companies window dressed as clinical research. It was left to the FDA to track the pills down and impound them. But some of them had already been distributed by doctors. All in all, in the United States, about 17 children were born with defects linked to thalidomide, with some dozens of other cases suspected. This whole story might have been little more than a footnote in history, were it not that a few months later, a reporter pieced the story together and identified Francis's role in averting the tragedy. In July 1962, his article appeared on the front page of the Washington Post under the headline, "Heroin of FDA Keeps Bad Drug Off Market." And in the wake of it, Francis was flooded with attention. She demurred at being called a heroine. She was part of a team, she said. All of them had worked together on the case, she said. Besides, things might have gone very differently if she hadn't had the stalwart support of her superiors. Capitalizing on the story, senators advanced legislation that directed the FDA not just to evaluate the safety of new drugs, as they had been doing, but also to evaluate their effectiveness. If companies wanted to sell new drugs, they had to show that they worked, and they had to report on any adverse effects. Also, companies couldn't send doctors untested drugs anymore. If patients were going to be in a clinical trial, they needed to give their informed consent. Congress passed the amendment unanimously. President John F. Kennedy signed it into law, and Francis was in the room when he did. President Kennedy would also award Francis the President's Award for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service, the nation's highest award of its kind. And over the course of her life, her work would be honored with many other awards and accolades. But Francis didn't chase recognition. After her moment in the spotlight, she returned to her work at the FDA. The temporary job she'd taken in the summer of 1960 turned into a 45-year career. When she finally retired in 2005, she was 90 years old. She died at the age of 101 at her daughter's home in London, Ontario. To me, this is the story of a trailblazing woman who defied the social conventions of her day to pursue work that she loved, the story of someone committed to science, and the story of someone who should be better remembered for her legacy. But that's not the only way people see this story. In an article entitled Two Thalidomide Disasters, Charles Hooper and David Henderson of the Cato Institute criticized the FDA and the laws passed in Francis's wake as regulatory burdens that have raised costs, pushed pharmaceutical companies into ever bigger conglomerates, and mired innovation in red tape. And that isn't entirely wrong. Regulation does slow down the release of new drugs, and regulators who bear the impossible burden of trying to prove that something is safe can be, understandably, I think, cautious to a fault. During the AIDS crisis of the 1980s, as dying patients clamored for experimental and potentially life-saving drugs, regulatory agencies dragged their feet. There is probably an optimum level of regulation, one that balances safety with innovation, but even if we could somehow find that optimum, it's undoubtedly a moving target. Sometimes circumstances require relaxed regulations, like during the COVID pandemic. Sometimes they demand more, like when underregulated herbal supplements started leading to dozens of cases of liver failure in the 2010s. Whatever the balance, the story of Frances Oldham Kelsey reminds me that this imperfect tension is better than the unregulated chaos that preceded it. When Frances was born, medical quackery was rampant. Fraudsters peddled their wares with impunity. Medical entrepreneurs with no training cooked up homemade liver pills and added radium to toothpaste. Not all of it was malicious. Well-intentioned pharmacists peddled untested remedies that they believed were good for their patients. And sometimes they were. And sometimes they were useless. And once in a while, they were truly dangerous. Those untested remedies sat on the shelves right next to proven ones like aspirin and iodine and epinephrine. Even with these effective medicines, dosages and purity, and even the claims about what they treated varied widely. Side effects went unaddressed and were often unknown. And the biggest casualty in all of this was trust. The boundary between science and salesmanship was so blurry that most people couldn't tell the difference. Practitioners of all kinds accused anyone they disagreed with of quackery. Regular people, desperate for relief for themselves or the people that they loved, had little recourse but to judge remedies on their advertisements. Taking a new medication was like an uncontrolled experiment on yourself. Today, people promise miracle cures just like they did. The internet runneth over with bloggers and Instagrammers hawking the latest fads. There are supplements and energy healers and people attributing magical powers to apple cider vinegar. What's different today is not the number of charlatans. What's different is how easy it is for patients and doctors to tell whether a treatment has been tested and what the risks are. The safety that this has given us is largely invisible. Most people have never heard of Frances Oldham Kelsey because you can't count the number of babies that weren't born with defects from thalidomide or the healthy people alive today who might have been its victims. I hardly think about the safety of the food that I buy in the grocery store. And when I go to the pharmacy, I never wonder whether the drugs I bring home will be cut with something cheaper or secretly mixed with antimony. Now, no drug is without risks, but I can know what drug I am getting and what the risks are. People disparage government regulation, but we have been saved from an untold number of thalidomide-like disasters because of government regulation and because of the hard and careful work of petty bureaucrats like Frances Oldham Kelsey. Today, people like her mostly work anonymously. Their jobs take skill and training that could make them a lot more money elsewhere. But despite that, people continue to devote their careers to keeping people safe. And I, for one, am so grateful that they do. Hey everyone, I just wanted to say thank you to everyone for watching and listening. My last episode on Ball Lightning was the most widely watched episode of I Heart This ever. If you haven't subscribed to my YouTube channel, please do. It's one of the number one ways you can support this show. Plus, the YouTube comments are a great way to share what you think about the stories I'd tell here. I'd love to read what you think about this or any other episode. You can also email me at ben@iheartthispodcast.com. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian E. Morrow Cribbs. Our website is iheartthispodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.